Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And what's it going to take, folks? What's it going to take? So what we just covered yesterday are the Toriaks. Now, keep in mind, let's keep in mind, at this point in time, as the Toriaks were being established, as, you know, let's even go back a little further. So the colonies were a part of the British Commonwealth, and the colonies started to bear the burden of these things called, these abominable acts called the Tariff Acts. And so actually the abominable tariffs were the tariffs put onto the South. The abominable acts were the stamp acts that the British Crown put on the colonies. Just, you know, kind of be clear, there's a few abominations in our history. And so, some recent presidents, such as Obama and Biden and so forth. And we'll get into the presidential focus soon. But I need to kind of to help everything get tied together. Now, as we look at the history, let's just look at the history of George Washington. George Washington was a political soldier. In other words, here was a man who dedicated his life to serving the crown and fighting wars upon the American soil for Britain. And as he started progressing, and I think he made it up to colonel, he was not ever selected for general. And this really got under his, it was a burr under his saddle. To basically lay out that prior to finally concluding that we needed to revolt against England, he was constantly trying to position himself to become a general for the British Crown. Now, as they started making decisions in Britain to say, you know, we're going to make the American colonies have a lot of money and resources, and we're going to start using them to pay for a lot of our debt, our war debt. And what we want to do is, and as a matter of fact, the Crown was already getting ready for an Indies trading company. I don't know if it was the East or the West, but one of the Indies trading companies was going to actually start managing the affairs, the mercantile affairs of the Crown in the Americas, in the American colonies. And so there was a lot of little things that were all happening in motion that really set these warning signs off to those who were in the colonies. And at this point in time, they became very adamant that no taxation without representation. This was a fundamental right of an Englishman. And they demanded representation. Now, let's just look at this analytically and say, what would have happened had Parliament and the Crown said, you know what, the last thing we wanted, they believed, I guess the best way to say this is, they had such tyrannical powers that they believed that they, you know, nothing could fall from their hands and grasp, and they believed they had all the control. And they believed that they could, and they did, and were going to subjugate the subjects of these colonies. And they weren't going to, you know, there's no way they were going to water down the House of Commons and the House of Lords with the blood of colonists. How dare they even think that? I mean, this was the self-righteous attitude of Parliament, and the king even supported it as well. And so, as we proved to you yesterday in the Tory Act, that where the Continental Congress solicited all of the petitions that the recent colonies had made to both Parliament and the Crown and their responses, because they were creating the empirical data or making the case with this empirical data that the Crown has basically abandoned their rights, that they do have rights as Englishmen, and these rights were well-founded and so forth and so on. And had they had any a scintilla, there's that beautiful word that has been illuminated by the tyrant King Obama, but had they even had a scintilla of justice and treated the American colonies justly, this was probably what would have happened. Now, this is a lot of supposition on my part, but I believe that they may have actually would have been able to create, and had they done this, this would have kept America as a part of the British Isle. And so I honestly believe that the divine hand of providence was directly involved in hardening the hearts and minds of those Englishmen so that America could actually break away and create a new paradigm of government. But they didn't actually do that initially with Continental Congress and the Articles of Association and Articles of Confederation. The evolution, as I've told you before, really took time, and it was over a decade from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution where we really formed a new government that has never been seen by the likes of mankind ever. And so as we ponder what would have happened had they had that scintilla of justice in their hearts to say, these are Englishmen, these are direct descendants, we have family between us, that what we need to do is we need to, and the Crown could have easily said, I will give the Americas a prince, maybe, or establish a bloodline of monarchy, because this is what's happened before. If you look at the monarchies of Europe, that's exactly how it happened. A bloodline was broken off, and that bloodline started a new nation. Now, let me even back up a little bit further. In the 1600s, and I forget the year, when Thomas Hobbes wrote Leviathan. Now, folks, you got to understand, this was the paradigm. This paradigm had permeated throughout Western society up to this point. And Hobbes was basically articulating that we were ruled by a divine bloodline that had been anointed by God to rule us, which is why every king and that bloodline required a coronation if you want to call it the prophet or the leader of his church. In other words, the Roman Empire and all of the Roman crowns that were created in Europe, that's how they were doing it. They were creating these different bloodlines or establishing a new bloodline by coronating it as God has spoken that this bloodline will be your ruler. Now, this is the paradigm. And when you look at the Magna Carta, most people miss this. But if you look at the Magna Carta chapter 61 and the right of petition, this is where we can clearly see King John willing to surrender his kingdom to the people if he does not redress their grievances within 40 days. What that means is that all that he has is to be given to the people until he redresses those grievances. But what it doesn't do is it does not remove the righteous crown which is on his head. In other words, he has been anointed by God, and there is no changing our ruler. He will surrender everything he has if he doesn't redress the grievances, but he cannot surrender what God has struck into stone, that he and his bloodline will rule the people of the British Isles. So as we look at how Hobbes really, he builds this case that this Leviathan has been established by God. Well, it didn't take long for a very astute man in England to actually challenge this. And this is why, you know, the framers, when they started getting these books, because these books were just mind-blowing. These people in the colonies and throughout the world reading Hobbes and then Locke and the two treatises of government. The two treatises of government blow out of the water the argument, that men were called of God to rule us. And Locke makes he makes the astute assessment by looking at Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. And he basically says that God holds each man accountable for their actions, not, you know, the whole argument under Hobbes and the whole argument under all of this is that when we look at a king or when we look at our ruler, you know, he provides the justice. He's the one that must, in God's name, extract justice. He is the magistrate. But Locke points out that in contrary to that concept, when Cain slew Abel, God did not go to Adam. God went to Cain himself and called him out and held and petitioned him and held him accountable. There you go. God petitioned Cain and held him accountable for his actions. And in so doing, he unleashed, you know, a curse put upon Cain. Now, this concept has been constant throughout the Bible. And Locke actually makes this point. As a matter of fact, he even goes down the point of the fact that as children, we're to obey our parents, you know, and we have these obligations of being obedient. And that are we not all the children of God? And so he really shatters this concept that a monarch actually has a divine role. They are no more divine than any parent, you know, on the face of the earth. He doesn't spell it out, but you can clearly see that societally or in a societal paradigm, it all, the fundamental element, the fundamental building block, all points to the family. Now, I write about this, but there have been a lot of injections placed on the, you know, the divine roles of a family and all of these types of things. But I believe that it's between God and that husband and wife to figure out how they can, you know, make their home, you know, a place where God would dwell, where his spirit would be, and how, you know, they may have to make compromises. Not necessarily compromises to his law or anything else, but I don't believe that it is unrighteous if all of a sudden a man becomes disabled, that a woman who has the ability to become educated or be the ability to contribute in a different way than the standard way. But that's between them and God, not between society. And so, you know, the concept and the constructs of the Old Testament and, the, you know, things are done in this very specific fashion, I think was really pushed into a whole new world when Christ came and changed the concept that we didn't have to offer offerings anymore, right? That we had this, I'll just say this, this opportunity and obligation to, you know, live his word. And, you know, when we fail, we're to repent. We are to repent. And the reason we don't do offerings anymore is because Christ had come and all had fulfilled the obligation of the offering through his atonement. But anyway, don't want to get down this path. What I want to do is I want to actually lay out now that we, Hobbes, and actually now that Locke has basically leveled and destroyed Hobbes' argument, the idea and the concept of this crown being so righteous started actually being, you know, permeated to where a century later, because I think Locke wrote his, Locke wrote his article on the two treatises of government. And as a matter of fact, I've got it. I'll look it up. And while I'm looking it up, I have to apologize for the frog in my throat. But as I look it up, I can tell you that it takes a while for these ideas and books to actually start moving forward. And so it was 1690 when Locke wrote the second treatise or treatises of government. And, you know, when he finished that book, are the two parts of that. And Hobbes wrote his Leviathan in 1651. So now that you got the dates, because sometimes people want to have the accurate times when these things were done, or, but, you know, give you a good snapshot. So it took a while to actually start really helping people chew and digest these words. I am surprised that John Locke wasn't hunted by the king and basically, you know, burned at the stake as a heretic. Because what he was basically saying was that you, as a crown, do not have, you know, God's anointment, you know, to rule us. You know, we've created a system that has been flawed. And as we, as like I said, as we kind of push forward, going into the Americas, the colonies, and so forth, these ideas were permeating. These ideas were actually spreading. So by the time these colonies actually started challenging their rights as Englishmen, on the table were these other philosophical ideas that were springing forth that challenged this old world paradigm. This old world paradigm that we, you know, had this magistrate form of government. Now, when they started breaking away, as, you know, well, I shouldn't say as they started responding to the aggressions of the British Crown and Parliament by laying and levying these stamp acts and these taxes. And as I told you before, I believe the tax on tea was like a tenth of a cent. And it was a matter of principle for these folks. It was a matter of principle, taxation without representation. Now, we do have representation today, but we also have a limited constitution that only grants the government to be able to do those things delegated. This is why I go through this, and I go through this to ad nauseum regarding why counties matter most and why it is so important that we actually institute, we actually formally institute our counties, and how to move forward in instituting counties within the state, and then those counties would then reinstitute that state government, peeling back and making it more compliant and more aligned with the U.S. Constitution, and peeling back many of the powers that the state has, and delegating only those powers necessary for that state to be able to engage actively and vigorously within this republic with other states within the union. And so, you know, one of those things is that the states cannot be subjugated by the federal government over commerce and so forth, as well as no state can dictate any commerce laws over other states. Anyway, I digress. The whole point is how we moved away from the magistrate model. Now, to be clear, the magistrate model and the mechanisms baked within it, i.e. the jural assemblies, or these assemblies, this right of the Englishman to resist tyranny from the crown, tyranny from Parliament, was baked within the English magistrate system. So in other words, the Tory acts, and I've kind of been alluding to this and pointing out the fact that these Tory acts were being done by the assemblies of people under the old model of the magistrate of government. We don't have a magistrate anymore. And as a matter of fact, when that constitution was ratified, we severed completely. The only reason that there have been any attachments to that old form of government is because there were old jurists, or I should say judges and courts and what have you, that didn't understand that those things were not applicable in this new form of government. The fact is that Anna von Ritz and many of these other sovereign citizen movements are convincing people that that form of that right, that fundamental right of our form of government still exists is one of the biggest lies and deceits, because no one has, you know, gotten to the point where, hey, hold on here. How did that, you know, how did that go from the monarchy into our constitutional republic? It didn't. In other words, folks, we don't have a need to have to oppose a magistrate, our king. We have the right to hold our representatives directly responsible in this new form of government, because our government, the magistrate itself, was severed into three separate branches. The one being the powerfulest, and the one that actually created the laws and executed the laws, was the legislator. Actually, the executive executed the laws via the legislature and we the people. So in other words, when you start looking at who's supposed to enforce the laws of the union, it's we the people. Go look at Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14 or 15. It says that Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia for the executive to execute the laws of the union. In other words, the executive doesn't create his own standing army like the Crown did. There was this dovetailing and this mutual symbiotic relationship between we the people and our government. We actually have a self-governing system. We don't have a magistrate system. We do not have a democracy. We have a constitutional republic. And so if all of a sudden we're being given laws or anything that is happening that is not within those powers granted under that constitution, it is our responsibility to hold those public servants responsible, which is why the right of petition was integrated into this constitution. I can't emphasize enough. I cannot emphasize enough how we have literally, we grew forward and we were so blessed and we had so many opportunities, but we failed. We failed to understand that severance. Many of the problems that I see come from the clinging on to old arcane ideas, definitions, where we still have these direct associations and ties. This is why a lot of people, I rub people the wrong way, because everybody that cites Blackstone and his commentaries on law and all of that, they're wrong. Blackstone and his commentaries were based on the monarchical form of government and that form of law. We needed a new Blackstone. What should have happened was somebody should have actually taken Madison's writings and Jefferson and these brilliant minds and actually said, now we have a new paradigm. We no longer have a magistrate. We have common law that is molded underneath the Constitution and no longer the Bible or a monarch. In other words, we don't have the theocracy where there's a coronation of those who rule us and creating bloodlines or anything like that. Now, it's about challenging paradigms. It's about helping people start recognizing that we literally have a government that you've never been taught. And that's, and Patrick Henry pointed this out. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me get back to this scintilla of justice. Had the king and had Parliament actually had some compassion in their bowels and, you know, the integrity of ensuring things be done justly, then it would have been a completely different history altogether. Because as we look at how the colonies literally started breaking away, they were maintaining the same model. It's almost as though we were going to have another iteration. And as a matter of fact, it was the design of Hamilton to model. And as a matter of fact, it almost lends to and supports the idea that he was an operative for the British Crown. And who knows, they might have actually, you know, been seeking to create a monarch that they could actually instill. But there were some very unique problems that were created by the Constitution that severed or created a wall of separation from the ability to establish a monarch. Because of the Bill of Rights or the lack of anything being delegated, they created this ability or this, I'll just say, I don't want to call it a wall of separation. I guess the way to call it or way to refer to this is, you know, the Establishment Clause forbids. It is a negative. The federal government could not establish a church. In other words, they couldn't establish themselves as a Christian nation or any really a form of faith. Why? You know, as a matter of fact, you have to understand this, because had they created a church, it would have only been a matter of time where the church would have actually started coronating our executive, and we would have been quickly going down the path of creating a monarchy in America. And so that was the intent, that was the design. And even, as a matter of fact, I would challenge anybody to go look at Hamilton's little rant as he left the Constitutional Convention to go back to New York. I think it was in July sometime. And I need to go find this myself, but just so I could actually read this to you, so you could have this. But I remember reading about how he kind of scolded the delegates at the Constitutional Convention because he said, we need to have a permanent king. You know, we need to have either a king or a permanent president. I think they didn't want to use the word king, and I don't think he actually used that. I think his idea was that we would create the position of the president should be stronger and should be, you know, more of like the sovereign, like a king, that it would be a permanent lifelong position, much like the judiciary, that the only thing that would be changing on term limits and so forth would be the legislative branch. They had already successfully instituted, and to me, I honestly believe that creating a permanent position for a federal judge has proven to be a not a guard, but a fallacy and a portal for judges to operate with immunity in perverting, you know, the law by being able to, you know, assume the powers that they have. They don't have any constitutional power to redefine things. They don't have legislative powers. Their opinions should be fully omitted from the public use and have no bearing whatsoever in a court of law. Opinions are opinions. And it's one thing within the theory of law in education to sit down and you know, mow through the opinions, but to allow them to have any bearing and effect on our law is absolutely unconstitutional. Because we actually, if you really think about it, we actually see a monarchical vein coming from the judiciary because, oh, well, John Marshall, this prince of America, uttered these words in an opinion, and that is like the bedrock of law, when it's not. Opinions, you know, are just that. They're opinions. They have no standing. The merits of the case is what has standing, and the ultimate ruling is what has. So in other words, the evidence and facts in the case, that's what has standing. This is what was presented, and therefore the conclusion, the ruling, is based upon those very specific definitions within the Constitution or very specifically within that jurisdiction. If the court doesn't have jurisdiction, they shouldn't even be hearing these cases. But there is no barrier regarding jurisdiction. I mean, hey, if we got two lawyers that are willing to, you know, go toe-to-toe over an issue, we're open to let you come in and spar. It's almost like our court system has become Ultimate Fighting, UFC. Like a UFC entertainment ring. That doesn't matter. I mean, you know, we'll let anybody and everybody come in here. The controls, the clear terms and definitions of what those courts, our federal courts, should be hearing is predicated right there in Article 3, Section 2, that says the court's jurisdiction, the power of the court, shall be over all things arising under this Constitution. Is the environment arising under this Constitution? I'm sorry, folks, it's not. Is marriage, does that arise under this? No, it does not. Anything regarding religion? No. As a matter of fact, they are to be the guardians to ensure that no law is ever established regarding religion. And yet they created law regarding religion to dictate that the secular godless religion of evolution is to be taught and shut down the ability for any other form of concepts and theories of how we were created, you know, creationism and all of that. I mean, so how is that not a law that violates the First Amendment? You see my point? So, and, you know, it probably helps if I had the time to sit down and write and articulate this, but there's no way to really do that without, you know, diving down all these rat holes anyway. But the fact of the matter is, had we, as the colonists at that point in time, been offered some justice and offered an olive branch by the king or by parliament, things would never, I mean, this whole world would be in a completely different state. And as a matter of fact, I believe evil would be completely abounding. The only reason evil has not been able to seize full control is because of this very Constitution that is protecting our rights. And the sovereign citizen movement is actually getting people to tread either on the line or cross that line, relinquishing their rights as a citizen under that Constitution. In other words, they've convinced people that this godly document is the problem. And there is absolutely no evidence. They can provide none that actually ties it to the Constitution. Everything that has been done from the banks, from the Assumption Act of the banks, doesn't even matter if the framers, I'm telling you, even Madison really didn't fully understand the Constitution. As brilliant as this man is, and as I consider myself Pell in comparison to his mind. I mean, Madison, it just amazes me, but I can actually see how he didn't see some of this stuff. And there's no doubt in my mind. Excuse me. I got to go frog hunting here one of these days. So anyway, I can't go without saying that had these men understood, you know, the brilliance and how this Constitution actually was God's plan. You can tell this is a pretty passionate issue for me. It was God's plan for governance for the world. It was to lay asunder all forms of government, that this form of government, that all people could be free, that all people could have a free exchange of ideas, a free open dialogue regarding religion, and all of those things put away the trappings and the machinations and the avarice and the deceits of men. And so we all can kind of see how, you know, we're the problem. The people are the problem. As a matter of fact, I tell people, you know, anybody that, you know, is either ready to check out or is overly abundant in, you know, how great people are and all of that, you know, I tell people that the greatest thing on this earth, you know, that we have access to is the people. The worst thing, the most destructive, the most evil thing on this earth that we, you know, we can be exposed to is the people, because we as people have, and we use our agency to either do, you know, righteous things or really evil things. And we're seeing more and more people exercising agency to do evil. And when I see how Satan wants to divide, it's not over, you know, a binary issue. It's not just one or two, which is why on Monday I kind of laid out the seven, as we call them, the seven, what are they? The seven paths. There you go. The seven paths of dealing with a government that is doing something, a wandering government. Now, you know, a wandering government in 1798 was the Alien Sedition Acts. We don't have a wandering government today. We have a rampant disregard and an abandonment of the law. I mean, it's not wandering. It is actually conducting warfare against us. I mean, if there's any point in time where we actually have to start engaging in controlling government, it's not using the status quo and allowing the parties to continue to keep us going down this path. We have to break away from the parties and demand or basically take full control over the parties to say either it's about constitutional compliance or nothing else. I mean, it is that only. And then, because if you think about it, what's the point of a party if all parties are a party system, if all parties fully embrace and demand the law of the land be followed, full compliance to the law? because the parties are the ones that kind of, oh, we want to spin it this way. We want to, you know, take some latitude and compromise this part of the Constitution. That's how, and that's why last year I went through an iteration, how I gave you a historic timeline of how the two parties in the 1820s, actually it was the 30s, when they started playing with each other, going back and forth, playing, I'll just say, Mutt and Jeff routine or good cop, bad cop routine, until they actually united and started working together to manipulate us. And that was galvanized in the 1850s, as I find out doing a little bit more research on this. The court system is not the path forward. It is, using the court system is tantamount to going to the mob and having them fix something for you. The Article 5 Convention is not the path forward. The Constitution's not the problem. I can't, you know, I'm blue in the face, folks. We have no problem with this divine document called the Constitution. If we were adhering to it and the federal government was actually in complete compliance of that, all of our problems, all, I say all, capital A-L-L, all of our problems would go away. That's a profound statement. I challenge anybody to prove me wrong. These other organizations that are trying to counter the Article 5 Convention, trying to bamboozle people to say, we got the Constitution's the problem, we got to fix the Constitution. They're lying to you. And the other organizations say, no, you don't need to fix the Constitution, we need to nullify. That is not the path forward. Every single one of these paths that I've given you so far is misleading you. It is a deceptive path that will not solve the problem. Nullification won't, nor will the sovereign citizen. And that's the whole point right now for the past 3 days that I have focused in proving that the sovereign citizen movement is a movement that is based on non-constitutional founding. We do not have legal rights to basically bond together to oppose our government by using committees of safety and so forth. We created a Republican form of government. We have our representatives. You may not like them, but you have to hold them accountable. And this is why nobody wants you to get engaged in First Amendment petitions, because you'll actually start shining the light on the problem and interposing. That is the only path forward, petitioning and interposing, petitioning and interposing. That is synonymous to what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison did with the resolutions. And they were petitioning at the government level, which is why when you really look at the petitions we're doing, these petitions start at your county level, and they demand that your county commissioners or supervisors petition all the other counties in the state to join them, like the Virginia and the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. That was at the state level. We have to start at the county level. Because we actually have an apparatus that is far more defined, and we actually can see how the structure is not just a simple shell of a state government. We actually have, you know, a structure that is even better defined than what those men understood. They didn't understand, you know, the government was going to grow to the level to where we needed constitutions at the county. I am here to tell you, if Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were alive, they would tell you that the first order of business is get your house in order, get your counties in line and in congruence and you know, in harmony with that Constitution and demanding full compliance to that Constitution, period. So what we have to do, folks, is we have to hold our public servants accountable and get rid of them via the election process. The election process, we can't use the party. It's one thing if you can co-opt the party, if you can actually get the party to say, we will fully support their oath of office and demand that they follow the oath and that they actually support the Constitution. Because when you read these petitions, that's what it all hinges on, is their legal obligation to support the Constitution. When you look at these petitions that we're handing your county commissioners or your supervisors, when you look at these petitions, they don't have to go and do a whole bunch of work. All they need to do is write an endorsement letter to say, we fully endorse and demand compliance of our state officials. And we demand every county in this state get on board with this. Basically, what we've done is we've taken exactly what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison have done and has started this at the county level, so that we can actually start holding our state government, because when the state government is equally corrupt as well as our county government, we have to clean up our county first. You can't clean up your state without your county. Your county will be will constantly be undermining you. We have to start at the bottom. But I'm telling you, God has shown his hand in many ways throughout the course of this nation, from its founding, from its discovery, and how things had laid out and played forward. You know, it wasn't, interestingly enough, it wasn't by chance that Portugal and Spain saw no favor in North America. And so Britain kind of stumbled across an economic powerhouse that they didn't even realize. It was Adam Smith that actually pointed it out in The Wealth of Nations of 1776, that pointed to the United States as, if the United States could actually get their arms wrapped around and create an intercommerce network of transportation, you know, highways, waterways, and so forth, in moving commerce more efficiently, we would destroy the world economically. We would seize control economically over the world. And that's exactly what we did. As the ball that we're riding on, this earth, as it evolved economically, and as we as a nation evolved, we actually outpaced the rest of the world, using some of the same technologies, the rail system, and so forth. Now, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter all of the foreign influence, and it doesn't matter all of the unconstitutional things that they've done. None of those things have any permanence. When we realize that there's no authority, there's no, you know, they don't have any authority to be involved in these things, the corporations, all of this stuff, it's a house of cards. We just blow it down. And what is left is this bedrock of a nation that has unlimited potential, that these sovereign states have every resource at their fingertips to be able to harvest and bring forward from, you know, the minerals under your soil, you know, in your land, the harvesting of your trees, every resource. The only reason that we're struggling today is because of what we call, you know, this federal government is actually made laws unconstitutional restricting us. The sovereign citizen movement is strictly a facade in getting people to look, and because there was nobody other than yours truly has said that was severed, it was broken because of the Constitution. Why is it that Madison didn't do that? That's why I'm saying I don't think he really understood. I think that they kind of understood, but nobody actually sat down and wrote a Blackstone commentary, or it should have been a Madison commentary on the law. It should have been a clear delineation, but maybe these guys' hands were kind of busy. We were in an infantile stage. It's kind of like when I started writing about Republic Review, about this concept of auditing, about this concept of holding the federal government accountable to the Constitution. You know, I didn't understand the importance of the county, the grassroots, all this other stuff. I knew it was important, but I said, this is the ultimate solution. And not that I was wrong, but over time I realized that I didn't have the clarity because it was still at an infantile stage as it was forming. It wasn't until, my involvement with the National Liberty Alliance, and you know, God bless John Durash and those good people with the National Liberty Alliance. You know, and having, you know, a little faith in me, and having, you know, I'll just say some patience with me in, you know, kind of helping get the arms around. Because in working with them, we clearly, or at least I was able to shine the light and be able to delineate, you know, what we needed to do and how to start taking back our county and forming a proper constitutional county. See, the thing was that we had these, or you know, these sheriffs and these groups out there that are saying, oh, well, we're a constitutional county. You know, that to me, that's just lipstick on a pig. What is the criteria for you to truly call yourself constitutional? What does that mean? Have you reestablished common law courts, and do you have a common law grand jury that's actually making declarations and indictments? No. Then you're not a constitutional county. Oh, no, hold on. You're paying dues to an organization. That's what makes you a constitutional county. And that, in my, it's a label. It's nothing. There's no substance to it. We have to institute our county. We have to have that constitution for the county. You understand now what it really takes to create a constitutional county? This is why I say we actually have to do a little organization. But I'm telling you that once we get a few counties doing this, and once we start creating a template, then we can perfect it through process improvement, that over time, every county constitution will probably be very easily formed. Very easily formed, and then what you do is you wait till you have a certain mass of counties. When you have 3/4 of the counties, you know, that all have constitutions, which if you look at it, this is why I go look at your state map and determine how many of your counties in your state are red. Easily 3/4. You should have no problem in New York or any other state that is a blue state in Illinois. Now, I'm just speaking out of turn because I haven't actually looked at every single state, but I've looked at the maps and I go, wow, that's a lot of red in those counties, or that's a lot of red counties in that state. And to me, my friends, we actually have the ability to start rewriting state constitutions in the midst of actually going after the federal government and holding the federal government fully accountable to their oaths of office and executing Republic Review. Republic Review is the, I'll just say, the political force enforcing our public servants at the federal level. You got to remember, our public servants are those legislators, right? Our legislators are the ones that choose the president if our Electoral College can't. Folks, I mean, we have all the control. We, the people, actually possess all the sovereignty and power. We just have to organize ourselves. It's really, I'm not trying to oversimplify it, but this isn't rocket science. We just need to understand what we're missing, and what we're missing is creating our constitutional counties and establishing or instituting our government in accordance with the Declaration of Independence, our fundamental documentation, the bedrock of what this nation was built upon, that we the people have the power. And so with that, I think I've, you know, harangued enough, and I think I've dragged a lot of dead horses today. I hope that by now you see the maniacal side of the sovereign citizen movements out there. We will talk a little bit more about this and how they appeal to you by not having to pay taxes. But we will be doing that in our next episode. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.